Hi M&Ms, welcome back to another episode of Murder & More. As always, I am your host, Kira. Just a quick reminder to listen to the very end of this episode to hear a promo of another podcast that I would love for you to go and listen to. Today I'm going to tell you about a killer who I learned about after watching a drama on ITV sometime last year about it, and I have been obsessed with ever since. Malcolm Webster was born on the 18th of April 1959 to Alexander Webster, a detective chief superintendent at the Metropolitan Police, and Odette Blewett, a former nurse. Malcolm's attention-seeking began when he was a child, when he was prone to pretending to faint. He also had a penchant for starting fires, which, if any of you are into your psychology or criminology, you'll know that that's a red flag. The McDonald Triad says there are three major signs that if two or more are present in a person, it suggests they may have violent or sociopathic tendencies, or probably both. These are wetting the bed, abusing animals, and an obsession with starting fires. This triad was proposed in a paper in the American Journal of Psychiatry entitled The Threat to Kill, written by a psychiatrist named J.M. McDonald. Malcolm left school at the age of 15 with no qualifications, but managed to find work as a bin man, driver, office clerk, and eventually ended up becoming a nurse. Suspicious deaths around Malcolm Webster began when he was 30 years old, when he worked at a hospital on a children's ward in Abu Dhabi in 1989. An investigation into three suspicious deaths of three children under his care began within 6 months of Malcolm starting work in there, which forced him to resign. All three children had died as a result of cardiac failure, which is highly unusual in a child. Whilst cardiomyopathy, ischemia, or arrhythmias can occur in children and cause heart failure, it's more likely that a child with cardiac failure was born with some sort of heart defect. Islamic culture forbids postmortems and prefers quick burials, so unfortunately there wasn't enough evidence to prove that the children were murdered and for the police to investigate the deaths. Malcolm's former girlfriend, Beth Brown, suggested that he had been injecting himself with insulin, which brought up the possibility that that may be how Malcolm killed the children. So I found a case study online. Some of you who know me personally will know that I work at my local hospital, so I love reading into medical things. Insulin injection in people who are not diabetics can cause that person to die. It can cause the person to become hypoglycemic, meaning their blood glucose level is too low, and can cause bradycardia, which is a low pulse, and hypotension, which is low blood pressure. If the hyperinsulinemia is not treated, the person can go into a hypoglycemic coma and will eventually pass away. It's believed that Malcolm's father used his influence as a senior police officer to help get Malcolm out of Abu Dhabi. Malcolm was described as a thief, liar and philanderer who habitually pursued wealthy women and would rely on them to supplement his income he earned as a nurse. On the 3rd of September 1993, Malcolm married Claire Morris, a 32-year-old from Aberdeen in Scotland. Throughout the couple's marriage, they had money problems, with regular arguments about Malcolm's excessive spending and landing them in a ton of debt as a result. Also, throughout the time they were married, Malcolm was drugging Claire with temazepam, a sedative that's part of a group of medications called benzodiazepines used to treat insomnia. Malcolm would typically crush up the tablet and sprinkle it in Claire's food and drink. On the 27th of May 1994, Malcolm drugged Claire, got her in the car and started driving. Malcolm then deliberately crashed their car, sending it over the side of an embankment, and got out, leaving a sedated Claire still in the car, before setting it on fire. An off-duty policeman happened to pass by the scene and offered Malcolm help, who twice told the officer that there was no one else in the car before it exploded. His excuse for telling the officer that there was no one else in the car was because he was confused from the crash and not thinking straight. Malcolm told police that he'd swerved to avoid hitting a motorcycle travelling in the opposite direction, who was in the wrong lane. He received a £200,000 payout from Claire's life insurance. Malcolm spent a week in hospital after the crash until doctors decided he'd suffered no injuries in the crash after extensive testing, although he claimed he'd suffered an injury to his neck and even went as far as wearing a neck brace to the funeral, I suppose to further reiterate that this was an accident. Claire's brother, Peter Morris, recalls encountering Malcolm at her funeral. He says, quote, "I had a very firm grip of his hand. He was actually squeezing my hand. Most people had their heads down, and I glanced at him and he was full of tears, as I was. And that convinced me up until 3 years ago that he had lost his wife in an accident. In reality, I was holding the hand of her murderer." End quote. Several people remain suspicious about Claire's death after her funeral. A police officer investigated the case in his spare time. He just felt like something was off with it. There were a few reasons he had concerns about Malcolm's story of events. Claire had not been able to escape from the car, which we now know is because she was sedated with temazepam. But obviously at the time, no one knew that. There were also no skid marks on the road, which contradicted Malcolm claiming he'd swerved to avoid a motorbike, indicating that the car was moving slowly. This police officer wasn't the only one who had his suspicions. Several firefighters that attended the scene also shared his concern. One firefighter said at the trial, quote, "I still think, why didn't the person who was there not pull the person out of the vehicle?" End quote. With another fireman telling the BBC, quote, "We all thought it was a bit hooky. There was no sign of violence to the vehicle. For a car to be stopped or parked and burst into flames does not occur, not unless it's in the movies." End quote. A friend of Claire's substantiated these thoughts, telling a public prosecutor in Scotland that Claire had told her she'd been in an accident some months earlier when Malcolm was driving, an accident that was very similar to the one that killed her. I assume that time maybe she wasn't drugged, or she was drugged earlier and the effects wore off by the time they crashed, and she was able to escape before he could set the car on fire. Either way, it was impossible for Claire to know that during that accident, she'd escaped her death, even just for a few months. Malcolm's next proper relationship was when he married oncology nurse Felicity Drum in April 1997 after meeting her at a dinner party in Saudi Arabia. Sometime after they wed, Felicity gave birth to a baby boy. It would be revealed years later at trial that on their honeymoon, Malcolm gave Felicity a drink, and after she drank it, she slept for 36 hours. So I have to assume that he drugged her the same way he drugged Claire. On another occasion, she slept for 18 hours, and she also suffered with double vision, with blood tests showing abnormalities with her liver function. Having done some research, temazepam doesn't seem to have any effect on liver function, so I have to assume he was drugging her with something else that affected her liver, or that this was just an incidental finding. Malcolm upped his game with Felicity, not just trying to kill her, but first setting not one, but three house fires during their marriage. The first fire was set in September 1997, not long after the couple got married. This fire took place in the cottage they lived in together in Line of Skene in Aberdeen, when he set fire to the living room furniture. The second fire took place in January 1999, in a house they were intending to buy in Bayswater in Auckland, as they were planning on moving to New Zealand to be closer to Felicity's family. The final fire took place just a month later, in February 1999, this time in Felicity's parents' house, where he set fire to an armchair. It's thought that he started this fire, perhaps in an effort to persuade Felicity to buy life insurance. As I mentioned, the couple were planning on buying a house in New Zealand, and I believe they were staying with Felicity's parents until the sale went through. Malcolm was having trouble with transferring his money from Scotland to a bank account in New Zealand. Well, that's what he told Felicity. The truth is, I'm not sure there was any money in Scotland. He was just using this as an excuse to buy time before he killed her. The couple had a deadline to pay for the house, the 12th of February 1999. On that day, Malcolm knew he had no way out and knew he had to act there and then. Otherwise, it would be revealed that he had no money. And I don't think he could handle that being common knowledge. I think he was too proud for anyone to know that he was bankrupt and in a ton of debt. Malcolm and Felicity drove to the bank on that day, but as they were driving, Malcolm suddenly told Felicity that the steering wheel had stopped working. They swerved all over the road, but when Felicity tried the steering wheel, she found it was working perfectly fine. Still, they swerved across two lanes before the car ended up in a ditch. Malcolm immediately jumped out of the car and went round to the boot. I assume he had petrol in there to set the car on fire. It was later revealed that Felicity had been sedated, and I think Malcolm was hoping that the sedative effect would have lasted longer than it did so he could kill Felicity. It's believed that Malcolm tried to murder her for the £1 million life insurance he'd set up for her himself after the three house fires he set didn't persuade her to get it out on herself. Felicity's parents already had their suspicions about Malcolm, but whilst they were driving to the bank, their fears were substantiated when they found documents relating to the life insurance and the fact that Malcolm had no money in his account back in England, as he had claimed. Her parents immediately began repeatedly trying to get hold of Felicity to warn her that he may not be the man she thought he was. Felicity recounted her ordeal to the Daily Record in 2014, saying, "I saw Malcolm about 300 yards down the track, pushing our son away in his buggy. I answered the phone and it was my dad saying, 'Wherever you are, you have to come home right now. It doesn't matter what Malcolm says, you have to get back immediately.' I called Malcolm and he had a complete meltdown. He screamed at me, "What the hell are you doing awake?" He said I shouldn't get up and to go back to sleep while he took our son for a walk in the buggy. He wanted to stay, but I said something major had happened at home and we had to go back. As we pulled up outside my parents' house, he said, "Your dad is going to tell you a lot of nonsense about me and your money." He left me and our son at the house, and he left before my parents got back. Okay guys, today's episode is sponsored by Ballsy. Let's be honest, no one likes smelly balls, right? With Valentine's Day fast approaching, are you worried about jumping into the sack with your partner and being faced with plums that smell like Wotsits? Then Ballsy's Your Incredibles Nut Rub Cologne gift set may be the perfect gift for your partner. This set contains three different scented nut rub colognes, featuring their most popular scents, Forest and Fields and Ocean and Air, and their limited edition Drift and Dunes scent. The retail price of this gift set is $45, but with my promo code MORE20, you can get 20% off. Ballsy is made in the US, is cruelty-free with no parabens, sulfates, or synthetic dyes. They also offer a 30-day money-back guarantee if you don't think the products are the dog's bollocks. So don't balls it up this Valentine's Day. Head over to ballwash.com, that's ballwash.com, to buy the perfect gift that will satisfy both you and your man. And don't forget to use our promo code MORE20. You'd be nuts not to. Four warrants were issued for Malcolm's arrest after he failed to turn up to court on several charges, with a police officer later stating, quote, "He failed to appear at court and full warrants were issued. They are still alive. Two of them are for arson. The third is for selling, giving, supplying, or administering a drug. And the fourth is for disabling or stupefying his victim, his then wife." The arson charges relate to a fire at the home of his then wife's parents. End quote. Felicity later confronted Malcolm, who she described as a psychopath, about his attempts to kill her, and all he said was that she would have died happy. Malcolm didn't stop with Felicity. After he fled New Zealand in 2000, he began a relationship with Christina Willis in 2002. Whilst there's no evidence that Malcolm tried to kill Christina, he regularly stole money from her, burnt a computer hard drive in her garden, and told her he had cancer, a lie that he would use again with his next and final girlfriend. Christina would later go on to tell the court at Malcolm's trial that he'd suggested that they both change their wills in each other's favour. Malcolm left Christina days after telling her he had leukaemia and told her the reason was because the diagnosis had just been awful news. But in reality, he left her because he'd found another woman who was independently wealthy and decided to move on to her instead. Simone Bernardi was Malcolm's last victim of his mental and physical abuse. He met her in December 2005 at a hospital they both worked at in Scotland and planned to marry her bigamously. Malcolm also told Simone that he had terminal leukaemia and went as far as shaving his head to convince her he was having chemotherapy. Malcolm moved in with Simone the following month after she became concerned about his health as he was undergoing chemotherapy. And by February 2006, just a couple of months after they got together, Simone had already changed her will to leave her entire estate, including her £270,000 house, to Malcolm. Malcolm and Simone's relationship moved fast, with them unsuccessfully trying IVF treatment just months after they got together. In September 2006, under a year after the couple got together, Malcolm proposed to Simone in a hotel in Scotland and later went on to buy her a £6,000 diamond ring. Felicity Drum's sister, Jane, was on a work assignment in Leeds in 2006 when she talked to a senior police officer there about her sister's experience with Malcolm Webster. This put Malcolm firmly on police's radar, and they started an inquiry into him, with Scottish police interviewing Jane. Police presented Simone with an Osmond letter in January 2008 at the hospital she worked at as a theatre manager, which warned her about Malcolm's past, informed her that he already had a wife and a son, and also warned her that her life would be in danger if she continued her relationship with him. Simone initially dismissed the letter as nonsense, choosing to believe her well-spoken, nicely dressed, well-mannered future husband, but later revealed that she believed he'd planned on killing her on their honeymoon and that she felt lucky to be alive. Simone was a frequent sailor, and she later stated, quote, "The foil on my life jacket had been punctured, and I hadn't checked my life jacket since I sailed with him. Everybody else's life jackets were fine, so I have pretty much no doubt that the boat was the way it was going to go." End quote. The day after receiving the Osmond letter, Simone knew that she had to confront Malcolm at the home they shared in Argyll, Scotland, with police in the street outside her house just in case. She did just that. As soon as Simone walked into the house, she said, quote, "I think there's something we need to discuss, namely Felicity. I can probably give you your engagement ring back at this point," end quote. Simone told the Daily Record that in response, Malcolm asked, quote, "I wondered when you would find out about Felicity. Who told you?" End quote. As soon as Simone told him that the police had informed her, there was a complete change. She recalls the horrifying moment she realised her fiancé wasn't who she thought he was. Quote, "It was like looking at a completely different person. It was not just that the colour drained from his face, but his whole facial expression changed. The closest I have seen to it was the footage on television of him at the crash scene when the jury were taken there. He was very, very different. It only lasted for a second. I got a brief glimpse of a different man, and the shutters came down and it was gone. The mask had slipped. If I could have disappeared into the floor at that point, I would have done so. That was the only time that I felt my life was in danger. The police were in the street outside, but that did not cross my mind. It was the scariest situation I have ever been in. It was the ultimate fear, and I have never been faced with a situation like that. I was completely at the mercy of the man before me. This was not my Malcolm." End quote. After Simone confronted Malcolm, he knew he'd lost the fight and went upstairs to pack a bag. Within half an hour of Simone confronting him, Malcolm had packed a rucksack and printed off a document to transfer his share of the £53,000 yacht the couple owned to Simone. Simone recalls this as being like a scene from a Hollywood movie. A month after Simone confronted Malcolm and he'd left the home the couple shared, Malcolm walked into A&E at Aberdeen Royal Infirmary, claiming to be suicidal. Simone's house was searched by police in 2007 when they learned that Malcolm had embezzled £5,000 from a local angling club that he was involved in. The police seized a laptop which had been reported stolen by the NHS and a gun that Malcolm claimed was an antique. Operation Field, an investigation into Malcolm Webster, began the following year where the police announced that they would be reinvestigating the death of Claire Morris, Malcolm's first wife. They also reinvestigated the crash in New Zealand. On the 30th of March 2008, Malcolm handed himself into a police station where he gave a no-comment interview. In December 2008, another woman who Malcolm had been seeing was also presented with an Osman letter, warning her of the danger she was in if she continued seeing Malcolm. A year after the investigation began, in 2009, Malcolm was arrested and charged by the Sheriff of Aberdeen for the murder of Claire Morris, the attempted murder of Felicity Drum, and attempting to bigamously marry Simone Banaji to gain access to her estate. Overall, Operation Field lasted 5 years, with 1,000 people being interviewed. Malcolm denied all charges against him, which also included starting a series of fires and several fraud charges, and his trial was the longest ever in Scotland against a single person, starting on the 1st of February 2011. On the 2nd of February, Simone Banaji told the court that Malcolm's spending habits were out of control and that she believed the money he had came from the sale of a flat in Brighton that he'd inherited from his uncle. In regards to Malcolm telling Simone that he had terminal leukemia, Simone told the court that he suffered from 10/30 syndrome, where his dizzy and fainting spells from the cancer treatment occurred like clockwork. She also told the court that Malcolm's fainting spells could be so bad that he'd have to crawl up the stairs to bed, or sometimes she'd even have to carry him. On the 11th of February, all 15 jurors, the judge and legal teams visited the location where Claire Morris died. On the 16th, a crash reconstruction expert told the jury that he believed the crash and fire in which Claire died was more than likely staged, saying that he doesn't believe the impact of the crash could have spontaneously caused the vehicle to set on fire. He also informed the jury that it was his belief that there would have been nothing preventing Claire from escaping the wreck if she had been conscious. On the 24th of March, Felicity Drum took the stand to tell the court how she slept for 36 hours after accepting a drink from Malcolm on their honeymoon. On the 29th of March, she told the court, quote, "I said it was quite clear his intention had been to kill me. He said I would have died happy. I had never been happier. He had given me love, marriage, and a child. In other words, I should be grateful. I felt sick and I felt repulsed by him. I had intended to spend the rest of my life with him." End quote. On the 5th of May, Malcolm took the stand in his own defence and denied murdering Claire, stating it was an accident, and denied attempting to murder Felicity. The jurors deliberated for less than 4 hours, and Malcolm Webster was found guilty of all charges on the 19th of May 2011 in Glasgow. 2 months later, on the 5th of July 2011, Malcolm was sentenced to life in prison with a minimum tariff of 30 years. He was subsequently removed from the nursing register, and Simone Banerjee is reported to have asked for him to be placed in solitary confinement, stating, quote, "He is a very good actor and would give Colin Firth a run for his money. He was charming, and that's what made him so plausible," end quote. Simone believes that Malcolm is a very clever man who learns from everyone he meets, and that if he were ever to be released from prison, he would be a sincere risk to society. And I think this is partly due to how unsuspecting he is, how clever and manipulative he is. It's been said that Malcolm has told other inmates that he expects to die in prison, and inmates have described him as a fairly boring person. He has tried to appeal his sentence several times, but these have all either been dropped by him or denied by the Scottish Criminal Cases Review Commission. Simone Banerjee told BBC News Scotland that while she will be able to trust people in the future, she'll definitely be much more wary of them and more questioning of their motives. Malcolm Webster is a clever, cunning, sociopathic individual, and I sincerely hope he remains behind bars for the rest of his life. As Simone said, "I truly believe that if Malcolm were ever to be released from prison, he would pose a serious risk to any woman he came into contact with, no matter how old he was. I believe the women of not just the UK, but the world, are a lot safer with Malcolm Webster locked up." Okay, you guys, thank you so much for listening to another episode of Murder and More. I have thoroughly enjoyed researching and writing about this case, and I hope you've enjoyed listening to it just as much. If you have enjoyed it, please don't forget to head over to Apple Podcasts to leave us a rating and review. If you are interested in supporting Murder and More further and love blooper episodes, I would love it if you could head over to Patreon and become a patron. As always, you can find us on Twitter at Murder and More, Instagram at Murder and More Pod, and Facebook at Murder and More Podcast. Don't forget to listen after the exit music to hear a promo of another podcast that I would love for you to listen to. Have a great week, you guys, and I'll see you all next week for another episode.
Morbidology is a weekly true crime podcast hosted by me, Emily G. Thompson, author of Unsolved Child Murders and co-author of Unsolved Murders, True Crime Cases Uncovered.
911 emergency.
My son shot my husband. I need an ambulance. He's bleeding.
Using investigative research combined with primary audio, including 911 calls, interviews, and trial testimony, Morbidology takes a look at some of the world's most heinous murders.
Do you know why you're here?
For a home invasion gone terribly wrong.
Listen to Morbidology now on Himalaya, Apple, Stitcher, Podbean, or wherever else you get podcasts.